Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll render unto Hail Caesar our thoughts on the 17th film from the Coen brothers, which features a huge cast, a sprawling story, and even a little singing and dancing. And in our second segment, we'll talk more generally about what we're calling entertainment about entertainment, from behind-the-scenes movies about movies to TV about making TV. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. StoryCorps travels the country collecting the wit, wisdom, and poetry in the stories of everyday people. The StoryCorps podcast showcases these unscripted stories about real life. Listen in and discover meaning in the words of someone you might not notice walking down the street. Find the StoryCorps podcast now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're talking about movies and movies about movies this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I review pictures for All Things Considered.
That's right, you sure do. And with Stephen Thompson out on assignment this week, he's been assigned to get some rest. We've also got Chris Klimek here with us. Chris, what do you do?
I review kinetoscopes. Kinescopes, kinegraphs.
That's right, you do.
Cinematographs.
You sometimes,
sometimes
do,
for you.
Right? Sometimes at NPR,
yes,
sometimes at other
yes.
places.
Spread it around.
That's right. This week we're starting with Hail Caesar, which is the 17th feature film from Joel and Ethan Coen, who have done comedies like Raising Arizona and The Big Lebowski, as well as heavier fare like Miller's Crossing and No Country for Old Men. This one feels a little like an anthology, a bunch of little vignettes stitched loosely together into a story about old Hollywood. Josh Brolin plays a fixer who deals with scandals and disasters like the kidnapping of a star played by George Clooney and the pregnancy of an unmarried starlet played by Scarlett Johansson. Now, Chris, you wrote the review of this for NPR. It was one of the kinescopes you reviewed
yeah.
for us. What was your bottom line on this movie?
Well, I like this movie a lot. And I keep reading things that are trying to persuade me that it's deep, just because it opens with a shot of Christ on the cross, mm-hmm. As does The Hateful Eight, actually.
That's right.
That
I thought about
that,
too.
Of it. And, you know, sort of weaves through this idea that the Josh Brolin character is suffering for the sins of others, is absorbing the sins of all the Capitol Pictures contract players
right.
and stars so that the wheels can keep turning. I don't know. I like the idea of, you know, the secret history of the motion picture business as run by this cabal of Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it can just be that. Like, this is a 4 out of 5 star Coen Brothers movie. It did not move me the way that Inside Llewyn Davis moved me, even though it is sort of episodic in the same way that, you know, we're interrupting the movie here and there for these little scenes from the movies in production
uh-huh.
that I'm sure we'll talk more about. But
uh-huh.
everyone loves these little vignettes that are sprinkled throughout the movie. The genre films that we're seeing, the little bit of the Western, the little bit of
right.
the musical, they're upbeat and fun. And the songs in Llewyn Davis are mournful.
Interesting.
And for some reason, I don't know, I guess the mournful speaks to me a little more.
I was sitting right behind Robert Siegel watching this picture, and he was going to interview Josh Brolin for All Things Considered. And he was laughing almost exclusively at the communism jokes.
Oh,
and it was really interesting. That wasn't registering for me particularly, and I was watching the bits that were sort of Esther Williams
right.
and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Tom Mix.
Sure.
But he was getting something else out of it, which was intriguing to me because I think the Coen brothers almost always give you this sort of cornucopia of stuff mm-hmm. that you can play with, and especially when they're playing with Hollywood.
Yeah. yeah. How do you fit this movie into their body of work?
Well, you said it right at the beginning, that they do a lot of pictures that are very serious, that are crime dramas, that are
right.
very centrally located in that place. And then in between, they do other kinds of movies. And the other kinds are usually something that riff off of Hollywood in some way.
Yeah.
Barton Fink
mm-hmm.
was a picture that was about a playwright who was writing for Hollywood for the first time.
For Capitol Pictures.
That's right. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
But they wrote it when they were having trouble writing Miller's Crossing, which
mm-hmm.
was one of their more serious pictures. They wrote it in 3 weeks and just sort of threw it together. This has the same feel as that in a way for me because it's frothy. It is a bunch of vignettes. It's just them having fun with the Hollywood tropes that they kind of like playing with.
Yeah.
yeah. This has a lot of disparate elements to it that, you know, and sometimes the Coen brothers don't feel like they cohere. There's always something left out there. But I loved everything I saw. Now, the trailers for this film give you the wrong impression and make you feel that this is more frenetic, more like a romp like Raising Arizona or Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. This seems to me to be something like Hudsucker Proxy shot through with a Serious Man.
It's
a little bit.
I thought about Serious Man too.
And you know, Chris, I would say it's a little bit deeper than you're giving it a little bit credit for.
Well, I'm not saying that it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it's about anything, it's about moral relativism for various reasons. I have theories about this film, but I also
think this would be a place to share them.
Well, I'll get to them. But right
bring
now,
Michael Gambon in here to elucidate. Some
can
of
I
your...
just have Michael Gambon narrate my life? Can we just have that? Mm-hmm. Because anytime you hear him, I was just grinning from ear to ear. Now, Chris, you've seen this film twice, so can you give me throw out some lines?
Another strand of gossamer weave.
There you go.
Another salve.
Nice.
Bomb.
Oh, Chris
Clement. It's so good. It's
nice.
So good.
Very
it's
good.
So much fun. What he actually says isn't necessarily great. How he says it is just a huge selling point. I do think it comments on Barton Fink in a real way. And here's my theory. Here's one of my many theories, that they have remade Sullivan's Travels twice. Sullivan's Travels is a 1941 film in which, spoiler alert, a filmmaker decides he's done with Hollywood because they do nothing but froth, and he wants to go out into the country and help people and do something real. He finds out, spoiler, that movies actually help people. Movies give people pleasure. And now, on paper, that sounds really like Hollywood patting itself on the back for being so wonderful. It doesn't come across that way in the film because Preston Sturges happens to be a good filmmaker. So Barton Fink is that same story, kind of, only really dark and surreal, where this Clifford Odets character, a playwright who is very, very serious and wants to help the working man, the common man.
He actually says exactly the same things that Joel McRae says in Sullivan's Travels.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, you know how the Coens feel about that character and his commitment to the working man. They're kind of making fun of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. They might believe it, but Barton Fink, the character, as played by John Turturro, is kind of a jerk. And that's kind of a thing. He's too serious. Here, they're taking that same conceit, but they believe in it because Josh Brolin believes in the magic of film, believes that they do something very important. And it's not made fun of. It's something they're taking as read. What I don't get is how the Coens feel about communism. That's one thing, again, for me, Bob, I don't know what that thread is. I'll probably have to see it again just to be able to piece it through. But I don't think it's as clear as Barton Fink.
That's a really interesting observation about how they're taking it more seriously this time. Do you think that's simply because they've been doing films for another couple of decades and that they've drunk the Kool-Aid now?
You could argue, and other people have, that there is always a notion in some of these films of a sort of internalized anti-Semitism. Especially in A Serious Man, but also in Barton Fink. And there's a thread of it here. When we open the door onto that room full of communists, it's like walking into temple. It's like, what are they doing? Well, obviously, they're doing something that they're kind of riffing on, history.
I also felt like we were walking into the results of the wonderful white male character actor over 50 Full Employment Act. I looked at that, and there are a couple of exceptions. I looked at it and I thought, you know those studies where they talk about like how many speaking roles there are for men and women and all that stuff? One movie like this throws this number so far in one direction because there are so many lovely little roles that are almost all men. You do have women. You have Scarlett Johansson for a short time. You have Tilda Swinton for a short time. But for the most part, you have just gigantic wall of dudes.
Yeah.
So there's, which is fine because they're all wonderful actors. You keep looking at it and you're like, oh, wow, that guy. And I remember when I saw that Krumholz was in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? Also? You know, because it's an embarrassment of riches in that.
And Dolph Lundgren. He's the submarine commander.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Man.
I think Glenn is very good at getting into the actual story they're trying to tell, which I'm really happy about. I had trouble latching onto it. What I was really into were the vignette pieces. Mm-hmm. And I think what I was really tickled by were, you know, Scarlett Johansson is basically playing Esther Williams, reimagined as a kind of New York gum-snapping, pregnant, single broad, which I don't think is necessarily at all who Esther Williams was, but in film terms. So you get kind of the underwater number, which, particularly for people who've never seen an Esther Williams movie or never seen Busby Berkeley choreography, I thought they handled that very well. And then when you talked about the trailer, this is a movie whose trailer is made for exactly the reaction it got, which is that when the trailer of this movie came out, people just said, oh, my God, I cannot wait to see this movie because it appears to be such an embarrassment of riches, which on the one hand it is, but on the other hand, a lot of times, what you see in the trailer is basically all you see of that person in the movie. The Jonah Hill thing, if you've seen the trailer, you've seen what Jonah Hill does in this movie for the most part. But for me, the centerpiece of this movie, because I am myself, is this sailor dance number.
No dames!
From Channing Tatum plays this guy who is like a, you know, star of musicals, who turns out to be important to the story as well. But you really meet him while they're shooting this dance number, and it's one of these Sailors on Leave musicals. And the thing I love about it, as a person who's seen a gazillion movie musicals many times, is that it's a blend, because the dance is Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra from like On the Town or Anchors Away, but the song is essentially, I have two clips for you. One is actually from No Dames. Jessica, can we get that one?
No dames, we might see some octopuses.
No dames,
or a half a dozen clams.
No dames,
we might even see a mermaid.
But mermaids got no
Okay, now I need my other clip.
Nothing else is built the same. Nothing in the world
has a soft and wavy frame like the silhouette of a dame.
There is absolutely nothing like the frame of a dame.
So the second clip is from There's Nothing Like a Dame from South Pacific, which is the song from which No Dames is essentially stolen, right down to the kind of comedic super low voice, which when I heard that in the theater, I was so delighted, because it's a little detail that if you know There's Nothing Like a Dame, it's a guy whose name is Stewpot, and he has kind of this comically low voice. It's kind of this lovely little wink. So that number is really well done. As Chris said in his review, Channing Tatum, a pretty good dancer. Who knew?
Probably most famous as the star of G.I. Joe Retaliation. Also can dance.
I am one of these people who is completely in the tank for Channing Tatum. And I think, as a longtime Gene Kelly fan, I see it. And not only because he's a wonderful dancer, but also because whatever he's doing, there's dancer physicality to it. And I think that's true in this movie, not only in that he basically is in two scenes in this movie, and it's true in both of them. So for me, those little numbers, those little bits are so delightful that that is what I was able to hook into. I did have a little more trouble being invested in this broader story that I could tell they wanted me to care about more than I did. I did not really care about the room full of communists. I think the early scene where Josh Brolin meets with the bunch of clergy guys is a fun scene. I felt like it kind of kept going, and I was trying to figure out, why are we still in this scene, and what am I meant to be getting out of it? But as I said on Twitter, it's not that I didn't like the movie, but I would rather have seen the rest of the Sailor movie.
That scene where Eddie Mannix is seeking the approval of the religious leaders for their prestige picture, Hail Caesar, I am sure this is not a deliberate reference the way that No Dames is referencing South Pacific. However, all I could think about, let me preface this by saying I have never seen the film Caligula, the notorious Bob Guccione of Penthouse, I think, or one of a dirty magazine producer tries to get into prestige epic filmmaking in the 70s. And this, by all accounts, disastrous and, you know, reprehensible film comes out of it. But I have seen pieces of the documentary, The Making of Gore Vidal's Caligula, because my old housemate used to show clips from it and quote it all the time, where you have Bob Guccione with his shirt unbuttoned down to his navel and his various gold chains explaining that no expense is being spared and we've hired the finest artisans to manufacture the reality of ancient Rome. That's probably not what they were specifically pointing towards, but that's what I was thinking of.
That's what I reminded you of. And I should say, when I rattled off the things that I enjoyed, there's also a very funny bit with Ralph Fiennes and young Alden Ehrenreich. Not somebody that I am hugely familiar with, but he's very funny in this movie, playing basically a stunt.
It's sort of Tom mixed with John Wayne in a way, and Clueless sort of in general, but can twirl a lasso.
I think he almost rides away with the movie, actually. Yeah. I mean, I think he is phenomenally good. Maybe I should have said that, too.
Yeah, well, and comes in to do this kind of drawing room film with Ralph Fiennes as Lawrence Lorentz.
It seems Allegra's a no-show, which is simply a bore. But I'll partner you in bridge.
Huh. Would that it were so simple.
Cut.
27 Apple, take two.
All right, let's try this. Your line, just say it as I say it. Say your line exactly as I'm about to.
Okay, sure.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were...
Wait, watch my mouth.
Such a goofy joke. The kind of elegant British director who then wants to coach him on how to speak.
Would that it were so simple.
No, you seem to be lingering. It's interminable, the were. I'm wondering when it'll end. Then we shouldn't be wondering, should we? We should be marching right along to so simple.
But that's a fun, yeah. I think, well-executed little bit.
But what is tying these things together, to the extent that it is, and I agree that it's sometimes you lose the thread, is the notion of moral relativism, or at least moral compromise. Eddie Mannix, he believes in the fiction of Hollywood, and when he goes to confession, he confesses tiny little things, not the things that we, the audience, have seen him doing, not these huge moral compromises he's making, these tiny little things.
Right. There's a wonderful moment in there where the weapons manufacturer guy is essentially says to him, you know, I have a chance for you to do something that's important that really matters. And later when he's describing this dilemma, he kind of says, what if you had a chance to do like one really important, meaningful, difficult thing or an easier thing? And you realize he thinks of Hollywood as the more meaningful, difficult thing.
No, that's it. That's exactly
he's,
it.
He's asking that question of his priest.
That's kind of why this film seems like a much sunnier version of Barton Fink.
I actually thought you were going to say that this is a sunnier, brighter version of Trumbo.
Yeah,
which
well,
it also
it
kind of is.
It kind of is, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a bit. But it's interesting to look at this movie in the context of all their other work. I mean, I am not somebody who has seen all 17 of these movies by any means. And the ones that I like are kind of all over the place. Like, I really, really love Raising Arizona. I also really, really love Fargo. Mm-hmm. And I also really love True Grit.
What's
you never know what you're going to get.
It's interesting what you just chose, though, because those are all not more serious pictures exactly, but they are more straight ahead, and they're not dependent on your knowing other things. I mean, when you look at something like Big Lebowski, if you don't know anything about Raymond Chandler, you're at a disadvantage
right.
with that one. And with this one, if you don't know who Esther Williams is, who Tom Mix is,
or what these sailor movies were, musicals were like,
right, mm-hmm. then you're at a complete loss. And so I think when they're making their strongest pictures, I think Fargo is a really strong picture. When they're making those pictures, they're not relying on other things in Hollywood. They're going it alone. They're doing it themselves, and usually really successfully.
But they're sticking to genre, though. Genre is what they do.
Sure.
You know, everybody always says, like, well, they're trying to make their entry in each genre, and I can sort of see that. But what I was surprised when I sat down and figured this out, how many period films they've made. It's almost like they're doing their August Wilson 20th century cycle or something. I actually broke this down. So, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is 1937, Barton Fink, 1941, Man Who Wasn't There, 1949, Hail Caesar. I put it at 1954 because of the reference to the H-bomb detonation at the Bikini Atoll.
Right.
Atoll.
Yeah, yeah,
atoll.
Yeah.
Whatever that word is. Hudsucker Proxy, 1958. Llewyn Davis, 61. Serious Man is sometime in the late 60s.
Yeah.
No Country for Old
this
Men is in 1980. And then I think Raising Arizona and Fargo are set in the present day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, roughly.
But
roughly
yeah, they. I mean, they've you know starting about 20 years prior to their own birth, they've kind of covered the whole century.
This is very interesting, Chris. I never
Thank
thought
you.
About it like that before. Look at you. Look at you, full of theories. You and Glenn, everybody's got theories.
No,
except
I'm gonna write that for the Dissolve. Oh shh.
All right. Well, I will be curious to hear what all of you thought of Hail Caesar. If you saw it, we didn't even talk about Clooney. Clooney's funny.
Clooney's
doesn't
funny.
Have that much to do.
He's no Alden Ehrenreich.
So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. Tell us what you thought about Hail Caesar and what you think of George Clooney and whether you need more stories about old Hollywood. And speaking of more stories about old Hollywood, when we come back, we're going to talk about entertainment. So stick around.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Chipotle. For 22 years, Chipotle has been committed to changing the norms of fast food by sourcing and serving real quality ingredients cooked with classic cooking techniques. But real food comes with real challenges. So when it comes to safety, rather than follow the norm, Chipotle's changing it, again. By adopting unprecedented new safety standards designed to put them well beyond current fast food norms. Because they believe when it comes to food, higher norms should be the norm.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, before the break, we were talking about Hail Caesar, which is a movie about the making of movies. We thought we would use our second segment today to broaden out and talk a little bit about other entertainment, about entertainment. One way I thought we might kick this off is I would love, if you would, if you have an example, one that you like, something that you are fond of that is an example of entertainment about entertainment, whether it's perhaps a novel about a novelist or a movie about movies or even a movie about making television, which also would count. So I'm going to just do a little quick whip around. Glenn, can you give me one?
My first thought was The Muppet Show, which is a behind-the-scenes look at a vaudeville theater. Now, The Muppet Show was made in the 70s, and they were pretending that vaudeville was still a thing.
Yes.
Now, today, the Muppets have a show on network TV where they run a late-night talk show, which is arguably as relevant to today as vaudeville was in 1977.
I hear ya. How about you, Chris? Do you have one?
Yeah, the first one I thought of was Sullivan's Travels, but that's probably because I was already in that Coen-y
sure.
headspace. So I went to The Player, Robert Altman movie from 1992. Nice. That does seem to be kind of putting the headstone on a certain era of studio filmmaking, but it's kind of this, this murder mystery satire.
Yeah.
I brought a clip.
Well, I'll talk to you about it later. I'm in the middle of the pitch. Okay. Listen.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's a TV star, and she goes on
like
safari
a
to Africa.
You're talking about a TV star in a motion picture, a major motion picture?
Not a TV star. It would be played by a star.
A movie star playing a television
Julia,
star in a major motion picture.
Would be good. Dolly Parton would be good.
Right.
Dolly.
I like Goldie.
Okay. Great. Goldie we have a relationship, and that would be great. Goldie goes to Africa.
Goldie goes to Africa.
Oh boy, it's been too long since I saw that.
So So that's one element that dates this, right? The notion that we would put a TV star in a major motion picture.
I can't believe it.
Yeah,
those
borders are a lot more porous now than they were in the early 90s.
Boy, that's for sure. How about you, Bob?
Well, can I leap to an entirely different style of entertainment?
Most definitely.
How about a Chorus Line? A Chorus Line is ran for 15 years on Broadway and was the story of a show that won, or of people who want to act on Broadway. And it gave birth to so many careers, it's almost scary.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about A Chorus Line is one way in which musicals about musicals have an advantage, of course, is that it gives you the obvious place to put the musical numbers. Mm-hmm. Whereas in A Chorus Line, they still do it the way they do in, like, Oklahoma, where people just start singing. It's not necessarily, some of them are like, the whole one thing is rehearsing a number.
Right.
And all that. But a lot of the rest of them are just people who start singing while they're talking, which is funny because in a musical about musicals and about musical theater people, a lot of times what you get is the thing where, the number in the show is the number in the show about the show.
Cabaret, for instance.
Or whatever. Yeah. One of the ones that I thought of, and I don't know why this flew into my head, I did reference a clip of it the other day, and maybe that's why it was still at the front of my mind. But Soap Dish, which is a 1991 sort of weirdly forgotten in the sense that it tends to kind of slide through the cracks and people sometimes forget what a sprawling and funny cast this was. Sally Field is very funny in it. Elizabeth Shue is in it. Kevin Kline is in it. Whoopi Goldberg is in it. Robert Downey Jr. is in it. Terry Hatcher is in it, if you were a Lois Lane person in the early 90s. There's a bunch of other people who are in this movie, and it is so funny and weird, and it's one of these broad comedies that I kind of feel like they stopped making at one point to everyone's detriment. But what I like about Soap Dish is it's about the making of a soap opera, and kind of almost like Jane the Virgin, it has a thing where it's about the thing and also is the thing and also is making fun of the thing because it sort of has soap opera tropes where people discover long-lost children and things like that. But it's also very much making fun of the business of making a soap opera.
Yeah. And in a film like that, we are okay with the fact that they are kind of doing a pastiche of how a thing like this would get made.
Right.
It is not a TikTok. It is not procedural. If you are a process nerd, this is not... Do not look here.
No.
Yeah.
No,
because there's things
not.
Like they do it live at some point, don't they, or something like that? And that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think that's a...
But think of
familiar.
Think of how often they use this as a trope in, like, Tootsie or Smash on TV. It's just something that entertainers keep on going back to because... What? Because it's something they know, obviously.
Yeah.
Because, Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
with sure.
Singing in the Rain. I mean, it's, look, there's I should forestall the 8 million how could you not mention.
Yes.
to which the answer is always the show is not 3 hours long. But even more than usual, this is something that is such a big thing.
Right.
You're never going to get your arms around all of it or even all
the
important stuff.
I decided not to try to do a piece on this for All Things Considered because when I went online and just looked at movies about making movies.
Right. Yeah.
They had 150 of them.
Right, yeah. Right.
Like, yeah, obscure films like Singing in the Rain, Eight yeah. and a Half, Sunset Boulevard. No,
just, there were just yeah. too many, and I wanted to mention so many of them, dozens of them. They're wonderful.
Well, I mean, we want to know the story behind the story, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to beat you to the Hamlet punch, Bob Mundell, yeah. because, I mean, ever since then, possibly even further back, as you suggested, but more contemporary, like The Larry Sanders Show is about a late-night talk mm-hmm. show in which actors portray versions of themselves, which very often is deadly. If it's
right.
too arch, if it's too faux-knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But that threaded the line really, really well. In The Player, same thing. We get versions of these characters, and the whole joke is that they're here too, which, again, it's very tough to do, but if it pulled off, it's pulled off.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I notice when I look at things like this is that it's easier to make one that I like when the people who make it aren't good at it. Mm-hmm. Sort of like in Soap Dish. You have that winking acknowledgement that people are making a very flawed product, but perhaps passionately so. Then when you have something like, look, I love Sports Night, but after that, Aaron Sorkin made a couple of other things about television, made Studio 60 and also
yep.
made The Newsroom.
There it is.
And the but okay, but
I agree.
But
completely
but,
agree.
But typically, and in all three
she
of those,
she hasn't said anything yet.
In all
whatever you're saying,
in all three of those cases, they're supposed to be very good at making what they make. But particularly, I think in the last two in that kind of trilogy of shows, you get so much interest in explaining people's greatness. That's not something that's unique to him at all.
Yeah.
But I think one problem with any project where you're taking a creative person and saying, "Let's discuss their genius." Right? And their process, you do risk people tuning out because it's not necessarily all that compelling. Whereas when you see people who are, I think that's one of the things that was so great about 30 Rock is that in 30 Rock, you kind of had the feeling that you loved all the people, but when they would show you little snippets of the show, it always seemed kind of dumb. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have that feeling that they were trying to explain genius.
Well, explaining genius is tough anyway. I mean, if you're trying to show the genius of writing, for instance, which people forever try to do on in film, all you can really do is have somebody sitting at a keyboard
yeah.
or scribbling. I mean,
it's terribly hard to make writing interesting.
It's really hard to do that. And I think in terms of musical comedy all the time, and there are so many musicals that are about the brilliance of musical performers.
Yeah.
Funny Girl being a mm-hmm. classic example. And the show isn't any good, but we so want to be involved in the story of this ugly duckling who becomes a swan,
right.
that you sort of go with it no matter what. And if you just give the audience a couple of ins, and, you know, Don't Rain on My Parade does that,
mm-hmm.
for instance, and it's just like, whoa, and then we're all with it. And I think we all sort of wanted to be, in our heads, we kind of want to be the star.
Yeah.
And so it's very appealing in these stories about entertainment that you watch somebody who starts out just like you or me and turns into something bigger. And that's a kind of a magical storyline.
Yeah.
Superhero origin story, in other words.
Oh, my God, you're right.
Yeah. What is it about musical comedy that they keep making musical comedies about musical comedies, like Kiss Me, Kate? It's about the tawdriness or whatever, the slap-together quality. Noises Off is not a musical comedy, but that's about how...
Speaking of untalented people trying to do
this. Yeah,
how thin
a
thread
theater.
A successful theater production is and how anything and many things can go wrong. Is it just that they're kind of pat themselves on the back?
Well, it's more that there's an interior joke. If you're watching something like Noises Off, you come in and they're making references to what the audience is like. And of course, the audience you're sitting out there in the audience and you're reacting to them. And then they show you what's going on behind the scenes and you realize what you're not seeing. That's letting you in on the joke in a different way. I think it's appealing to be able to reveal the work that goes into entertainment. You know, Penn and Teller are always talking about how what is miraculous about what they do is that no one in the audience believes that anyone would work as hard as they do to make something look so effortless.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, when you watch a movie that is about making movies, it's a way to translate the struggle to be creative, which I do think a lot of people feel they can relate to, because even if you're not a person who makes movies or dances or writes novels or what have you, you perhaps have had that experience of trying to get to the point where you feel fulfilled by whatever your work is. And so it's a way to kind of put that on the screen. And I think that's one of the reasons why when you don't start off trying to prove genius, you have an easier time, with me at least. Because, you know, Chris mentioned Singing in the Rain. If you look at that movie, there's not necessarily, you know, they're trying to get to the point where they're making a good movie. It's not necessarily the case that you're supposed to assume that all these people are great at making movies when it starts, even the hero. Because when you see the silent movies that Gene Kelly was making prior to when he kind of gets into musicals and talkies happen and all that stuff, they're not very good. It's not a movie about his genius. It's a movie about how he learns to make one good thing, really. And it's a movie, of course, which... because, like, as we were saying, it gives you a reason to put in all this. You know, there's this, in Singing in the Rain, there's not only the film ballets, which are sort of their own thing, but also the number with the guy with all the, when he's singing Beautiful Girl, and there's all the girls in the fashion outfits and stuff like that. That's a number that's just, it's just there because you can, because when you structure something as being about musicals, you can just write whatever you want. And that's essentially what Hail Caesar, that's how Hail Caesar gets that Channing Tatum sailor dance in there, is if you make it about people who make musicals, all of a sudden you have a place to put a musical number.
Yeah.
Well, again, I will be curious to hear about all of your favorite examples of entertainment about entertainment, because, and understand, we did not get to everything.
No, we got to them all.
I want to hear about your favorites. I want to hear about what makes them work for you or not work for you. Am I right or am I wrong that they work better when the product is not necessarily a work of genius? So come and find us on Facebook or tweet at us and let us know what you think. Now, when we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from IMG. Presenting Academy Award-winning director Michael Moore's newest film, Where to Invade Next, a provocative and subversive comedy about finding solutions to America's problems in unlikely places. Where to Invade Next is coming to theaters just in time for election season. See it at a theater near you Friday, February 12th, and visit wheretoinvadenext.com for more details.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment and my favorite part of every week. What is making us happy this week? Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, bud?
Okay, couple things quickly. The Criterion Blu-ray of the aforementioned Inside Llewyn Davis just came out. So among the extras on this disc is a concert film from a show at Town Hall in New York City in 2013, just prior to the release of the movie, where Oscar Isaac performed, but the Punch Brothers were there, and T-Bone Burnett, who, you know, got everybody together for the soundtrack, and Jack White and Rhiannon Giddens and all these, you know, Americana-adjacent performers. It's great. Other thing, I just got a galley of Stephen Hyden's new book. He is part of the Grantland diaspora. I don't know that he has another job yet, but his book, Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, is coming out in May. This is about pop music rivalries. The book just got here, so I have only read the first chapter about the great Blur versus Oasis battle of the mid-90s, but it's terrific. I've always admired his writing. Looking forward to unpacking the rest of that. And the last thing that is making me happy this week is an unlikely bit of synchronicity. Jess, if you would please play clip number 3.
I offer a toast. The undiscovered country. The future.
The undiscovered country.
Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1.
You have not experienced Shakespeare until you have read him in the original Klingon.
So that's General Chang. He's probably Captain Von Trapp to you, or Mike Wallace, or Leo Tolstoy, or Julius Caesar. No, that of course is Star Trek VI: The Undiscovered Country from 1991, which is being shown at the Library of Congress on Friday for free. Part of their series, Music from Mars, which highlights science fiction films featuring great musical scores.
Wow.
My friend Solomon has curated this. I got to see a pristine 35 millimeter print of Predator there two Fridays ago. Or as I remarked on Twitter, being in the cast of that film is a more reliable harbinger of electoral success than a degree from the Kennedy School of Government. When you look at who's in that film.
Rock on.
Anyway, I'm going to see this movie 2 days after I sit down with the linguist who Paramount Pictures hired to create the Klingon language. About 35 years ago. His name is Mark Ockrand. He is on the board of a theater company here in D.C. I'm going to talk to him for a project that I will be able to say more about in a few months. But the fact that I am going to meet with the guy who translated Shakespeare into Klingon and then go see the movie by pure happenstance, it's making me happy.
That's amazing. That should make you happy. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Two things. The Twitter account called Batman 66 Labels.
Oh, yes.
Is exactly that. It is no more than that. It is no less than that. It is exactly that. On the television series Batman, starring Adam West and Burt Ward from 1966 to 1968, they threw labels on every prop just for funsies. And these
How
are just...
do you know which one is the shark repellent bat spray
exactly,
if it's not labeled?
Exactly. You need to know these things. So this one dude, I think, just freeze framing all kinds of scenes from every label. It's soothing in a very weird way. The other thing is a novel called The Queen of the Night by
yes.
Alexander Chi. It is about a hugely popular soprano in Paris in the late 1880s or so. And we find out very, very soon that she has not always been the toast of Paris. She has remade herself multiple times. And I know nothing about opera. I know nothing about the Second Empire in France. I know nothing about basically anything this book covers. And yet, the tone and the attention to detail and the prose is so clear. There's all the stuff about, you know, the dresses she wears and how important they are, and that's usually stuff that just leaves me cold. But because she is so good at imparting to us why she cares as much as she does, that you totally get it. Now, full disclosure, I know Alex. We have gone shopping for comics together, which is as close to male bonding as I will ever get.
I was just going to say, that's intimate for you.
But that has nothing to do with how much I am loving this book. It's The Queen of the Night by Alexander Chi.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I'm a theater critic at heart, as are these guys, actually.
That's right.
Glenn and Chris
I'm
both,
the only
right?
heathen.
Yeah, we need you back, by the way, Bob.
Well, thank you for that. But as a result of that, when I watch a show like Better Call Saul, I get very excited about the leading lady, as it were, Rae Seahorn, because she was an actress here in Washington for quite a few years. I used to see her at places like Woolly Mammoth Theater Company. And Better Call Saul is just back this week, and I watched the first episode, and she has an enormous part in it. I'd like to play a little bit of her. There is a very expensive liquor that they are drinking. They've figured out a scam that they can sit down and they can drink a lot of it at someone else's expense.
Oh, yeah. Compliments at the bartender. She thought you might want a souvenir.
Oh, my God. Did we drink the entire bottle?
No, yeah, we didn't. Hey, cheers.
I think we're ready for the check.
I love this woman. I have seen her in a whole bunch of things here in Washington where she was all kinds of gorgeous and wonderful and just a really talented actress. Here, I'm only getting to see her do one of the many things she does. It's still very exciting to see her as a successful actress in Hollywood. This is really fantastic, and she really deserved it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bob Mondello. I'm going to start by picking up on what Bob said just for a moment and noting that friend of the show and produced an episode of the show, Sarah Ventry, who works out in public radio in Arizona and used to be an intern at NPR, wrote a piece for Monkey See just the other day about Better Call Saul and about why it is very relatable to see a person who is trying to remain a good person in spite of enormous pressure who you know will eventually lose when so many people spend so much of their lives in that hustle. It's a good piece. I recommend that piece from Sarah. As for the rest of what is making me happy this week, I have been trying to do something when I am unavoidably watching silly things on television besides just watching silly things on television. This has meant that I have started making stuff. I was showing these guys earlier my mittens that I made myself out of felt. Which
white and baby blue and adorable.
Which I'm waving right now. I made some felt ones. I also made some fleece ones. There are some pictures of them on Twitter. And also, I've been knitting an incredibly unruly thing that started off as a scarf and is going to wind up as a shawl probably because it gets bigger. It's a thing that happens when you knit. You add stitches and you don't know why. I'm very bad at it so far, but this is really what's making me happy about it, in addition to the fact that I now have a really warm pair of fleece mittens that I made myself out of fabric, which is kind of amazing. I feel like I made fire. I feel like I created fire. What is really amazing about it is, you know, we talk so much about social media and what brings out negative things in people about the internet. If you ever want to see the real positive side of the internet and social media and engagement with other people, become a person who needs help with crafts. Hmm. Because if you say, I am accidentally adding stitches to this thing that I'm knitting and I do not know what is going on, people will flock to be helpful. And it is...
I see what you did there.
It is, flock. I know. It is kind of amazing. And I have been really, it's very sweet. People are really, really eager to jump in and help and give advice. And I realized that nothing brings out the best in people quite like giving them something useful to do, whether it's actual advice or whether it's just the empathy of saying, that happens to me every time I try to sew something, don't worry about it. When you give people the opportunity to be helpful to you, they really want to do it. It sounds so goofy, but it really has made me feel better about being kind of in the universe of Twitter and all that stuff, to be reminded that a lot of times people are idle. They don't know if you're really listening. So a lot of what you get is kind of white noise because they're forgetting that you're a person. But when they know that you're a person because you need something and they can help you, all of a sudden you get back into that person-to-person kind of mode. And I've had a lovely experience with people just being full of good advice and encouragement, and also people who are just like, knitting, I love knitting! And then they're just super excited that you're talking about it. Anyway, so what is making me happy this week is in large part the kindness of the crafty internet. Cross-stitch internet also. So
that's
so,
the dark net that I hear that's right. sometimes.
No, they're so, also very nice on the cross-stitch.
Stay away from latch hook rugging. And those people.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katz of KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
It was great to be.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. StoryCorps travels the country collecting the wit, wisdom, and poetry in the stories of everyday people. The StoryCorps podcast showcases these unscripted stories about real life. Listen in and discover meaning in the words of someone you might not notice walking down the street. Find the StoryCorps podcast now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.